best part of the whole entire book. I recommend you to get it. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Gary Malta.
Thank you so much. I have a book by you. It's their mic, but I'm old wire. My favorite Dr. Leslie Nielsen, maybe you remember him. He had this microphone and went to a special place. Thank you, gone through the cup. Well, I was listening to my bizarre kind of background, and I'd like to make a disclaimer. I wasn't paid by him, so I wouldn't take the blame for what over there. And interestingly enough, that when I defected from the Soviet Union, well, the word to defect, I don't like this word because it means that you gave up something you believed in. And that was never the case with me. But when I would say, missed my train and ended up in Washington, D.C., then I was hired to work for the second largest bureaucracy of this planet, for the federal government in Washington. And I worked with a congressional think tank. I call the United States Institute of Peace, which, like, I think most government think tanks did a lot of thinking, but not the other thing. Not much of thinking, that's for sure. And since 1991, I do what I really like to do, to teach young Americans ideas of freedom, ideas of our founding fathers. That's why United States, for us, back in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, was a beacon of freedom. However, having said that, in the West, we don't fully realize the amount of crimes and lies which were produced by socialists. A great demographer, Rudy Rama, from the University of Hawaii, he wrote several books on something he called democide. Democide would be when governments are murdering their own people. He calculated that human toll of socialists in the 20th century was 172 million people, murdered by their own governments, not during wars, but in the peacetime. And the human toll in the country I came from, Soviet Union, he puts it at 61 million people. 61 million people. Well, even 61 or less or more is difficult to say. Because Stalin used to say that death of one person is a tragedy. Death of millions is just statistic, nothing else. And I remember very well myself when Mr. Gorbachev declared the policy of glasnost after the dreadful nuclear power station accident in Chernobyl. That would be the 24th anniversary of which will be on the 26th of April, just a week from now. And at that time, even here, being a dictator, being a general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, he was not told what is really happening. And then he decided to have this policy of glasnost, which is not freedom of speech, but openness, to prevent these things from happening. And as a part of this policy of glasnost, he decided to put his government ministers on TV, to have the first full-team programs. Before Gorbachev, who was elected General Secretary of the Communist Party of Soviet Union, on the 23rd of March, 1985, well, having said that, he was elected by 11 people, members of Politburo, so he wasn't elected by the masses. And that time was very interesting. Why did they elect a relatively young person? Because the period of Soviet history before his election as a general secretary is known in Russian history as a reign of corpses in Moscow, reign of corpses. They had this, I think George Herbert Walker Bush was vice president, Reagan's vice president, and he was a frequent flyer to all this all his funerals in Moscow. We would see him all the time. They even used to say that working day in Kremlin begins with resuscitation. Yeah. They give orders to pedals and then at the end of the day it's creating a death game. And why is that? Because in Soviet Union, like in all other socialist countries, if you will just think about it, people cannot quit. If you are a dictator, you are a hostage to your own crimes. If you quit, you are dead. If you quit, your family will be dead. So that's why we see that many people who are the fellows of bad societies, of totalitarian societies, and socialism inevitably leads to these kind of societies, they would never quit. They would all die. That's why they have this as leaders of the Soviet Union. Today we see the same thing with Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin, the leader of Russia, and his spokesman, Mr. Medvedev, these people will stay where they are forever and ever, because they know that they already have quite a trail of crimes and lies. And so that's what became back to Mr. Gorbachev. So he put a chief of the KGB, Mr. Kruchkov, on the spot, on Siberia. And people were calling and asking questions. And one person called him and he said that he was a famous historian, dissident historian, Goran Medvedev. And he said that Mr. Kruchkov, Goran Kruchkov, said that I calculated that the human toll of socialism in the Soviet Union is 43 million people, which were murdered by your institution. Is it a true number or not? And Mr. Kruchkov said, oh, I don't know. I mean, how would I know? Give me a week. In a week I will come back and we will continue this discussion. And I thought it was amazing that next week the whole country was glued to TV screens. Because it's really amazing how many millions of skeletons you come to your country. And Mr. Kruchkov appeared there, everybody was watching. It was just like a great soccer play or whatever. Nobody on the streets, everybody listening to the chief of the KGB. And he said, well, the number is about right, Congress. However, it's preposterous to believe that these people were murdered. Most of them died of natural causes. And the moderator, she was pretty nice. She said, well, if you don't feed people, then they probably die of natural causes. Then if you send them without clothes to Siberia, then probably they perish there also of natural causes. Then he kind of downplayed. He said, actually, to tell you the truth, he said, people die everywhere, including premises of the KGB. But it happened that 43 million people, according to him. So is it 43 or is it 61? It doesn't matter much to me. It's the amount of crimes which human history didn't know before. Human toll of socialism in China is 78 million people. Even in a small Cuba, 270,000 people were murdered and 4 million people fled from Cuba, living in Miami, Spain, in Mexico, in Argentina. It's a huge human community, it's a huge human community. So anywhere this system would be practiced, everywhere it led to mass murder. There's a wonderful video which was produced by young Latvian producer Edvin Schnorr. I'm not working for him on commission or otherwise, but I would strongly recommend you. One thing is to buy this video for your library. It's a great video. And tomorrow, I brought this video from Wisconsin. It's licensed for educational use, so you can watch it tomorrow at 10 p.m. in our room in a place called IMU. So this video would be screened tomorrow at 10 p.m. in the IMU room and in IO room, which makes sense if you are in Iowa. interior is amazing. Because my I am kind of a specialist in transitional economics. So my field of study is Russia, Eastern Europe mostly. However, this video was an eye-opener even for me. I found so many new things which I didn't know about the country I lived most of my life in. What is there? One thing is that Edward Snorri, he got access to classified materials of even Milutin Karl Marx. Amazingly enough, that a lot of Marx and Lenin's writings were classified in the Soviet Union and other communist countries just because they're so horrific that they decided to keep them away from the general public. There is, for example, there's a footage here of Marx writings in 1848. He was the owner and chief editor of Neue Rheinische Zeitung, a German newspaper, in which he was talking about racial crush in Europe. That in Europe, his point is that some ethnic groups are so backward, that they never can embrace his great teaching. They never can become true revolutionaries because they're so backward. And he mentioned Scottish Islanders, Irish people, Basques, Poles, Serbs, and he made a point that these people should be discarded. They should go through the Holocaust of history. And that's Karl Marx. Another editorial he wrote in the Rheinische Zeitung is self-descriptive. The absurdity of Poland. There are a lot of other things here. It's just amazing. It's an interview with George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw was a great sympathizer of socialism. When I was a student at Moscow State University, we were forced to read his book called The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism. He was the founder and the chairman of something called Fabian Society. And there's an interview with him in which he's saying, ladies and gentlemen, you probably, like myself, know about many people who would have difficulties in justifying their existence. And I would pray, dear scientists, can you please find some humane gas that we can put these people to sleep? Because those who consume more than they produce should be discarded. To use the same Marxist slogan, discarded. Another, it's already not from this video, but under Yeltsin, there was some window of freedom from 1991 to approximately 1994. So between independence, between the fall of Soviet Union, which happened on the 24th of December of 1991, and beginning of the first Chechen War, which ended civil rights and human liberties in Russia. At that time, there was a window of freedom and archives were open. It was Lenin's writings. For example, 1922, Lenin was writing to Felix Dzerzhinsky, who was the founder of CK, the predecessor of KGB, the same institution. And he is writing to him, dear Felix, I am telling many comrades, and they don't listen. And I am thinking, what if we will shoot a couple of them publicly? So attention span would be better. And they shot a couple publicly, and people became attentive. Then they began to shoot more, and they got all the attention they needed. And amazingly enough, for me as an economist, it's interesting, it's a direct correlation between the number of deaths, and the rates of economic growth. Soviet Union became a superpower in the 1930s, at the end of the 1930s, when they were murdering people 12,000 a day. 12,000 a day. Why would that happen? Well, that happens because under socialist economic system, it's not actually an economic system. It is a simple system of management. People are working because they are told to. And else if they don't work. And because of that, the more people you kill, they can do the better, the more, the better people would work. Because there's no other incentives to work except fear, And coming a little bit ahead, what Mr. Gorbachev did, and why he should be credited for the demise of the Hebrew Empire, that he removed fear out of the system, which was glued only by fear. If he would do that deliberately, he would be considered the greatest person in Russian history, one of the greatest people in the world history. But he did it kind of inadvertently. When I was working with his administration, he was all the time like a parrot, repeating on and on about the human face of socialism, which sounded like an oxymoron to me. And at that time, to make a long story short, there was kind of a popular joke during the perestroika in Moscow that the CIA sent their best to Moscow to find out what this perestroika is all about. And the CIA guy, he goes from one store to another, and I'm associated with traffic in the stores, on long lines for nothing. He walks into a butcher shop, say, right there, no meat. Goes to the bakery, right there, no bread. Going to the shoe store, right there, no shoes. And there's a KGB guy overlooking his shoulder. He said, 10 years ago, you would be shot for doing that. He writes there, no bullets. That's exactly what happened. When people realize the reality of the Buddhists, that they lost their nervous impetus, then people stopped working. I realized that the demise of that system is coming because I had a secretary, very nice young lady, Lena. She was a student, living student of the Moscow State University, and came from a very, I would say, kind of elite family of communist administrators. And once I noticed that she is putting paper clips into her purse. And I said, Lena, why are you stealing state property in such a strange form, paper clips? And I don't know what she said. She said, Yuri, what else can I take from this? And she used a very bad word. Office. So the point, I'll take that. And I was amazed that I was going back home. I was thinking that if the youngest and the brightest of the future of the country are going to work just to see what they can steal there today, then that system is doomed. It has a lot of analogs with, and I can put an analogy with slavery. Like slavery, then there were some people would make decisions, all decisions for other people. What is freedom? It's philosophical, you would think about that. Freedom is choice. So slaves, either under private slavery or public slavery, which was socialism inevitably would lead to, they cannot make choices. The choices are made for them by someone else. And I don't think that the popularity of socialism, why it's so popular, because it appeals to intellectuals, Patrick Barron quoted, and that's very kind of, for me, it's a great honor to be even compared or put on the same list of paper with Friedrich Haber's von Hayek. That's exactly what he meant. He meant that socialism is giving to intellectuals a claim to power because they know better. They know better what other people. So there are great masses and people with vision, people who decide for others what kind of circumstances they should live in, what kind of everything they should have. And that's the essence of socialism. Socialism is very attractive. Too many people, Václav Havel, a great playwright, Czech playwright, and the dissident who spent 8 years in communist prison himself, he used to say that if you are 20 and you are not a socialist, you don't have a car. But if you are 30 and still a socialist, you don't have brains. And that's exactly it. Several times, I remember even Yeltsin would say that his heart would be, he said, would say, my heart is left of the center, left of the center. However, by my logic and my reason, I understand that it is the place of no return, the place of no return. So this is kind of in the essence what I think we're discussing, whether it's socialism or not. Then dealing with today's socialism. I believe that the collapse of Soviet Union definitely was a great event for the whole humankind. It was a great liberating experience for 15 countries enslaved in the Soviet Union, which now are free, or relatively free. Even Putin's Russia, I made some comments about that, Mr. Putin. Even Putin's Russia is a great leap forward in comparison to communism. It's already people have more choices. It's definitely very sad for me as a metric Russian to see how people elected in the free elections in March of 2000, elected a KGB, proud KGB colonel, to be president of free Russia. That was my last article, which was published on Russian's website, in which I wrote in Russian. It has self-descriptive title. The title of it is, "Me voted for meat grinder." it is, can imagine, in a country where anywhere from 43 to 61 million people were murdered by KGB, then the proud KGB, not dependent, proud KGB officer is being elected by 73% of popular vote in free elections. That was the last free election. Since then, he is winning all elections just because, not because he would not be elected, he is popular, but he has made the this way to rig elections. So he is rigging just out of fun of it. And the whole country today is run by his institution, by KGB's, today it's called FSB, which is exactly the same as it was, the same people sitting in the same buildings doing the same kind of dirty work, And immediately now that Austrian economists, they all the time, Hayek and von Mises and many other Austrian economists, they were the first to see the flaws of socialism. In 1918, just 6 months after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, von Mises wrote a short essay, "Economic Calculation on the Socialist Commonwealth," in which he said that this is not an economic system, it's a simple system of management. He also made, in later work of human action, he made a distinction between two different types of socialism. That one is Soviet type, when the whole country is run like a post office, from the office of Postmaster General. And the defining definition of socialism is government ownership. So if you have government ownership expanding, then this is the way to socialism, that socialize. Another form of socialism was a Nazi, a German pattern of socialism. German pattern of socialism is when private property is officially recognized. However, de facto, it is phony. It's like you have a title for weapons in the United States. You cannot do anything. You cannot even camp there. So then the government would be telling you where to open, when to close, what to produce, how much for whom, what prices to charge, whom to fire, whom to hire, and everything else. Amazingly now that this Nazi pattern of socialism was not invented by Hitler, it was invented by Lenin. And by Marx was talking about that. But Lenin, in 1908, he already wrote that the first stage, he believes, of socialism would be when private capitalists would work for the government. We would force them. So their private property or everything else does not make any sense. So these are two different types of socialism. And government interventionism leads to that type of socialism inevitably. Isn't it now that I was kind of speaking about Hayek, I was converted by reading his book, Road to Serpent, which I would strongly recommend to everybody to read, because if you didn't read it, then I am even happiest that you will have such a delightful time reading it. And this Road to Serpent is dedicated by Hayek to socialists of all parties. To socialists of all parties. Because he believed that in every party there are socialists. And Road to Serpent in the Soviet Union was prohibited, was an activist of the KGB. I was given a blind copy just for one night. If I was destroyed reading it, I would get a maximum 6 years of jail. A person who gave me that book would get anywhere from 10 to 14 years of jail for disseminating of anti-Soviet slander. That was the infamous Article 57 of Penal Code. Now I'm giving my students extra credit for reading this book. The Soviet Union collapsed when in that window of freedom, they published Road to Serpent in Russian language, 7 million copies. 7 million books. It's an amazing thing. I was in China recently and I saw myself a long line in a bookstore for Road to Serpent, which is translated into Chinese language. So it's we should keep in mind also the famous dictum of Hayek that economic and political freedom, they are two sides of one coin. You cannot have one without another. And China is changing today, and we see that the more economic freedom they permit to their people, the more these people would demand human freedom, because they're inseparable, human freedom and economic freedom. However, we should keep in mind that the basis of human freedom is property rights. Property rights. James Madison said that property rights are the mother of all rights. No other human rights can exist without property rights. Can you imagine if government ownership on press, on our own mass media, whatever, then who will give space and newspaper or radio time or TV time to people who are against government? It's only plurality of private property that make it possible for people to have their own radio stations. Michael McCain from Fairfield has a wonderful radio free market, wonderful radio station, so you can tune in. There's a wonderful collection of lectures there and other education materials. Just go to radiofreemarket.com. Under socialism, under communism, that never would work. And sure enough that Mr. Putin and others at KGB, when they took over Russia, that the first thing they prohibited was freedom of press. That's definitely the topic on socialism is so broad, and I tell the truth, kind of torn apart between discussing what is happening, say, in Russia or Eastern Europe, because it's amazing for an economist to see how human freedom and economic freedom is the source of wealth and prosperity. That countries of former Soviet Union, which have chosen freedom, today are prosperous, not only free, but also prosperous. Those countries which did not are decimated and failing economies and failing states. So Adam Smith's idea from Wealth of Nations that it is human freedom which is the source of wealth is well illustrated by that fact. We can discuss that. But countries like Baltic States, or Poland, or Czech Republic, they are doing so much better than the countries which did not choose freedom, like, say, Kazakhstan, Armenia, or Moldova, or Belarus. So this is, I think, a very interesting topic to discuss and to do further research. What is happening in Eastern Europe? What is happening in this country? So what I'm thinking of that, what if we will go to discussion that would be of interest to you? What if your comments and your questions are my story.
Do you think communism is compatible with democracy? And do you think capitalism is compatible with democracy? And why or why not?
All right, well, socialism and democracy, that's just the Communist Party slogan. Because you cannot have socialism and democracy. Obvious why, again, because if you have government owning everything, then you wouldn't have any kind of plurality of views. You wouldn't have competition, because what socialism is ultimately a monopoly on power, monopoly of government on everything. So there was never an example of any communist country, socialist country, and there were 33 of them who would be even relatively free under that economic system. With capitalism, it is democracy compatible or not? Well, democracy has a lot of problems associated with it. And Friedrich Hayek, and today is a famous economist, Hans Hermann Hoppe, they are talking about whether a capitalist and democracy can coexist. Why the problem is? The problem is that democracy is, by many, it is associated with kind of Benbaum's view of utilitarianism. The most good for the most people. So, in other words, that means the rule of majority. Rule of majority can protect freedom only if the rights of minorities would be protected. If the rights of minorities are ignored, then definitely democracy can lead to absolutely awful things. You remember Adolf Hitler was elected democratically to be a chancellor of Germany. Vladimir Putin was elected democratically as a leader. Under democracy, there is a strong urge also for redistribution of property and denial of property rights. Why? Because rich people are what? Minorities. Right? So why we would not, for example, now hold them up and divide the loot? Why not? So that's Reagan's slogan was based on expropriators or looters. That was the social enemy is extremely powerful. I'm talking about minorities of all minorities. Minorities are ethnic, race minorities, religious minorities, minorities of thought. So that's democracy is in many cases creates a lot of difficulties for minorities.
There's been a lot of criticism against the President of the United States of people whose political views fall right up center, I would say. Main of the criticism is that he is a socialist or a socialistic leader. Do you believe that criticism is true?
Well, I mean, this is not about the personalities. I'm not a member of any political party myself. However, many of the policies of his administration and previous administration and administration before him were socialistic. It's kind of, for me, it's very strange to hear, for example, that we have like a free market screwed up everything. And that was George W. Bush, presumably a free marketeer. It was all nowhere. As I say, if you will look at the economic policies, I don't see much of a difference. I see bigger government is getting bigger. And the next strange thing is the amount of propaganda. And I go to Cuba quite often. I'm taking my students because it's the best inoculation against socialism, it's just to see how this beautiful life is completely ruined and destroyed. And then we have Michael Moore, who is talking about healthcare, great healthcare achievements in Cuba. I've been very nice to Cuba. I have a lot of Cuban friends from my Moscow days who are in Cuba. And the only help here in Cuba is to swim to Miami.
You can either take micro economics or you can take
theory of price system. So it's another chance of substitutes for each other. However, how many of you were interested in prices of healthcare services than you were facing? No, we are not price sensitive. 54% today of expenditures on healthcare are paid by government. Paid by government, 54%. Look at federal government, state government, local government, you look at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Veterans Hospital. No. So it's already Medicare. We're going back to systems. Therefore, so we need more government. So that's what Hayek was making the point. That usually what the government is creating problems, so we need more government to do that. So instead of creating price system in healthcare, well, we have that. I came from a country which was the first to nationalize healthcare in 1918. And healthcare was considered to be a human right under socialism. Right? This is the right for free healthcare, dental care was not. In Russia today, even today's Russia, when they're kind of recovering from this, life expectancy for men is 57, for women 66. Infant mortality rate is coming through the roof, 40. In some parts of Russia, like Chechnya or whatever, it's over 100. It's a Yeltsin called Russia cold Africa. And just thinking about the amount of social problems and economic problems. So that's, and if it didn't work anywhere, why should we have it?
You talked about two big obstacles. When you look at the future of our country economically, what are your predictions? And if we're heading in the direction of failure, what will bring us back to the ground?
Well, predictions, I'm kind of very cautious with predictions. I had my first boss was in Soviet Union, was a minister for labor of the Soviet Union. He was a Politburo member. And he once took me to Switzerland for the International Labor Conference. And as for most of the Soviet bureaucrats, he would get drunk and very talkative. he would teach me life all the time. He would say, Yuri, say, the future is bright and shining. Today is filled with a great effort and hard labor. It is past, which is dark and unpredictable. and I would say there is some point in that, yes. Because for the future, what can we say? I mean, it's usually a pendulum to some extent. I think that we'll, after this period of mass socialization, we will go somewhere else and do something. However, usually what happens that one party is increasing the role of government, another one would never decrease it, just fine-tune it a little bit, and that's about it. And do the official increase as well, of that part of government, that they like. We still, having said all of this, I can put a disclaimer that as bad as we are, everybody else is even worse. So if you will look at the conditions of human freedom and conditions of economic efficiency, still the United States is a leader in that. And so still we should definitely understand our problems and deal with them. However, from another hand, I just don't see that countries like, for example, BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, that they would take over us or not. They would only if they would become more free. My line of predictions are based only on simple economic theory, which was, again, founded by Adam Peterson, Adam Smith, by people like Mrs. Hayek, that wealth is based on freedom. So the more free we will be, the better our future will be, and the better we will be richer and free. So that's the...
Well, like you said, you're laying out the price system, having to either given the choice to like expand or further, kind of just tweak it and not really make it smaller. So how can we use democracy to, instead of like expand it so to reduce the size of government.
Well, I think our political system still is better than any kind of civil wars. That, however, from another hand, yes, we have two parties, and I remember when I came to Washington, D.C., was invited by San Francisco for lunch. San Francisco was a great economist and great journalist working for LA Times. He died maybe 6, 7 years ago. And San Francisco said, Yuri, we have two party system. And I was saying, what are you telling me? Everybody knows that. He said, one party is stupid and another evil. And I said, well, which one is which? And he said, oh, you need to pick yourself. So that's the, however, and that's another kind of thing, that it is difficult to say that we can develop a multi-party system. Because if you have a third party, that would cannibalize one of the two big parties. You see what I mean? That means that for example, you're voting for the Greens, then you would harm Democrats. If you are voting for Libertarians, that would harm Republicans. And so it's kind of a pretty tough choice. In many countries of Europe, they have multi-party system. For example, my wife is from Lithuania. And in Lithuania, they have 21 parties in parliament. Canada has 21 parties. So it can only rule by coalitions. Which, from my point of view, is a very nice form of government. Because they have these parties, for example, there's a farmer's party or a fisherman's party or other parties of vested interest. So you cannot have a majority under this. You don't have enough fishermen or enough farmers. So you need to have coalitions. That's the system which exists in Italy also, in many Denmark, Sweden. So you have this. However, you never can push something really serious because then the coalition would fall apart. So you need to come up with something which would not offend anybody, which is very difficult to do. However, it is another way of saying in Poland we have a peer leadership party or two other parties and many different parties for all choices. But the two-party system
Can you maybe talk about some of the things you experienced in the Soviet Union regarding the police state or kind of enforcement arm of the Communist Party? And maybe if you could draw some parallels if you see anything similar today in the United States.
About police state. So the question was about police state. How similar we are to the Soviet Union today. Well, I would say that in some cases, pretty similar. In some cases, we are much better off definitely than in the Soviet Union. What I would say similar, today we talked with Chad that we have, for example, politicians like Rudy Giuliani or Elliot Spitzer or many others, they made their name and popularity, but for example, arresting people publicly. You can see this, there was traitors for Giuliani was arresting people. Or Elliot Spitzer, who was fighting prostitution in New York at the same time sleeping with a prostitute in New York. He wrote a wonderful essay, which is also part of his book, Institution of Liberty, Why Only the Wars Are Coming to the Top. So that's his point, is that it's kind of adverse selection, that if you have something positive to offer, you will grab your mouthwash or toilet paper or something. But if you don't, then you become a politician. So that's pretty cynical kind of approach towards politics. But I see that a lot of, especially today, animosity in political sphere, a lot of names calling, a lot of things like that. From another hand, it's maybe even good that politics should be competitive because I said that one is stupid and another evil. I think the most evil and stupid would be bipartisan.
We have time for two more questions.
I think your central thesis is basically not that socialism or communism just has not worked, but that it cannot work.
by explaining, you know, the equals to the orders of the South, out in Germany. And I mean, that's literally, I don't know many people today would think that Stalin and Stalin's Russia was a horrible place, Nazi and Nazi Germany was a horrible place, that was a horrible person. But you invoke names like Marx and Lenin in a way that this is intended to draw sort of a direct comparison between what Marx said and what Lenin said and what happened in Stalin's Russia. And you say you invoke a particular article by Marx about discarding certain backward populations. And you talk about how even Stalin and Stalin's Russia had to sort of censor some of Marx's Lenin's writings. But in any substantial comparison between Stalin and Marx, or between Lenin and Marx, and between Lenin and Stalin, there are vast differences that would completely destroy any comparison or sort of disproving what Marx said by what happened in Stalin's Russia. Stalin killed, for advocating a more orthodox Marxist position against the Stalinist regime. Lenin, toward the end of his life, was not a fan of Stalin. And even Lenin and Trotsky, in their initial writings, were already making direct contradiction between what they thought and what Marx and Engels were alive under Stalin's Russia. They would have been some of the leaders opposing what happened in Stalin's Russia. So I'm just concerned that you're using the use of Stalinist Russia as an example of why socialism cannot work. It's more of an example that it has not worked, but that other ideas of socialism and communism can work.
Well, I'd be happy to have a semester-long seminar on Marxism. And I can say that I do qualify. I was forced to graduate from University of Marxism and Leninism in Moscow, besides my classes at Moscow State University. And I can say that the difference between all these thinkers, I think there's no difference. They're just spiders in the same jar. They are mass murderers. All of us. Marx didn't have a chance to kill so many people, so he didn't. However, he wrote to Engels in 1871, when the Paris Commune, he was saying that we literally need to clean up the house. We need to kill. And we would be considered as terrorists and mass murderers, and we don't care about it. That's Marx. Lenin, he is all covered with blood and minced meat. Under his watch, there are so many millions of people died. So many people were killed by him. Amazingly enough, he mentioned Stalin. There's an interesting memoirs by Andrei Sudoplatov. He was a chief of SMERSH, that's a KGB outer commune. Intelligence, or whatever it was. Intelligence, but yes, the Sudoplatov, he worked under Stalin. And he is writing that he believes Stalin would be a people's person in comparison to Lenin. Lenin was more ruthless. Under Lenin, one of his first acts was this movie tomorrow. Just watch it. Yes, that's which is what is not on the movie. For example, one person is writing him, saying that, look, one of the party secretaries, you sent us a memorandum that we should fight religion. How we should fight it? Lenin writes there, imbecile you, kill religious people. That's what he said. Lenin is a leader of social insulin, and he's got no prize for that.
Last question.
Thank you.
kind of several questions I can see here. One is that there is a socialism in Western Europe. No, there is not. I mean, socialism is again government ownership. And if you look at the countries like Sweden or Finland or Denmark, which are considered to be, they exercise a lot of redistributional policies, which you can call socialistic. If you have if you feel that maternity leave is a socialism, it is not. It is not the definition.
I think sort of the way you resolve here.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm not saying that healthcare run by government would be better. Why should it be if it was worse than in almost every other place? So it's not that when we're talking about Western Europe, we should keep in mind that they're essentially market economies. Market economies. That's why we have high standard of living. Socialism means more you have it, the worse it is. So if you have an income, you have legal problems. If you have more, then you have more problems. If you have all of it, then you have mass murdering in enormous proportions. So that's the part of ancient markets. I think that doesn't illustrate the case for big government intervention. The governments in places like Taiwan or South Korea or Hong Kong or Singapore, they all stepped up. I mean, Singapore, the only place they would find any people for spitting or whatever. So some people think that that's a big government kind of intervention. However, that is the economy. These are the freest countries, the freest free market countries in the world. If you look, there's an index of economic freedom, which is published by Fraser Institute in Canada. Every year, you can just put economic freedom. You will see that countries, as you mentioned, are the freest ones. The countries even in Western Europe, like Denmark, is a free country. However, they have maternity leave and they have government-run healthcare. So it's not that, but that's not because of that they are free and prosperous. You know, they are prosperous because they are free in all other ways. It's much easier to start a business in Denmark or Ireland, for that matter, or Finland. We have this experiments with socializing everything. Plus, we have the highest in the world corporate tax rate, 35%. So it's, we have all of it, but now we have court cases in Congress which are saying that we should have value-added tax. And I even had some people from here talked recently to couple of Republicans who think that that's a great idea. However, they don't understand, they think that VAT, value-added tax, would replace income tax. No, this is not the case. It would be on the top of income tax. And so if you do things like that, then you're losing comparative advantage. You are losing comparative advantage of freedom. So that countries which will be more free will overtake us, will win in economic
discussion.
Okay. Any closing comments? Alright, last one. All right, well, when the government... We should kind of begin with 101 economics. Because if you have a market economy, then the supreme commander of the market economy is consumer, you are. And if you are not buying General Motors vehicles, then now the government is saying that you should. Because who is deciding who should fail, who should prosper? By buying something else, you are saying, don't produce this. You are going to the whatever, pharmacy, buying, say, grass, food. You are saying, produce more of that, don't produce apple fresh, I don't want it. So that's exactly what the role of consumer in the economy is. The consumers decide whom to hire and whom to fire. The consumers, and then the government is just creating huge inefficiencies. Because it's also very strange to believe. I mean, it's I think a lot of seminars in Washington, D.C., some government economists. And
just was telling we were talking about that if we don't would not take over General Motors and Chrysler, then we would have massive unemployment. To say that means that we should admit that people would not buy any cars anymore. These are bad management structures. They stifle a lot of labor and capital inside them. So if you have a huge insurance company or a bank or General Motors to fail, these people would not just lay down and die. No, they would. If we need insurance, if we need to buy cars, if we need, they will go and find a job which will be efficient for all of us. That's the nature of crisis is, even from Marx's point of view, if you will look at it, Marx was closer to truth than most of the Keynesian crowd which are in Washington D.C. right now. Because Marx, as well, Mises and other both classical, neoclassical economists believe that the crisis, the depression, is needed because the bubble of bad decisions is being burst. That we accumulate a lot of bad decisions. It's kind of Marx even, he used quite a colorful language, that we need to clean body economic from the feces of bad decisions and investments. So now we are being told that we shouldn't do that we should keep everything inside. And this is that was never been. However, the only thing I think that you should understand is that it was not some kind of free market which created this problem. We had a chief central planner, Alan Greenspan, who was engineering this crisis together with the President Carter, with the Community Reinvestment Act, with a lot of other things which piled on each other to the point that the market was completely destroyed, and now we see these problems coming. However, to bail out, to keep what should otherwise go, is a very unwise policy, because you are not solving problems, you are just pushing them down the road, so not you, but maybe your children or grandchildren will deal with that when this bubble will grow out of proportion. So I'm pretty sure that there will be no bailouts. If too big to fail would fail, then I think we would have maybe deeper crisis, but much shorter. Much shorter. Now we have government selling houses scenario. You will look at the HUD website. HUD website. All the houses they gave for a song, now they are selling it for nothing. For nothing. And amazingly enough, because there is kind of interesting for me, because the real estate market, I think, is the best indicator of the state of our economy today. They are selling these houses, this, in most cases, the slums, for $5,000, $10,000. The overhead of government keeping these houses is hundreds of thousands of dollars per house. So what kind of efficiency we can talk about? Why this is happening? Because there's no profit motive. Profit became a bad word in the present terms. Profit, 50 years ago. Our profit is the best indicator of economic efficiency. If you don't have profit motive, then why not? Your government official can make bad decisions consistently. And nobody would fund you. If you are a private entrepreneur and making bad decisions, the market would sort it out. Nobody would give you any more money. It was too waste. So that's the... Well, on this cheerful note, I think. I'd like to thank you very much.